Hey there, Solar Warriors. I'm Nico Johnson, and this is Suncast. Each week, I pull back the veil on the life and business insights of clean tech entrepreneurs building the most noble and impactful companies of our time. I hope what you learn from this conversation is a catalyst for your own growth. So thanks for tuning in, and welcome to our tribe. Hey there, Solar Warrior. Welcome back. This is another Tactical Tuesday. Conversations with subject matter experts designed to give you practical tools, tips, and advice for building your clean energy business or career and grow with us here on Suncast. If you've missed some of our longer form conversations recently, namely James Warden and George Hirschman, collectively more than 4 hours worth of listening pleasure, I don't blame you. And so you're here now in a Tactical Tuesday because you like shorter form content. Thank you for giving me that signal. I've done a little bit of extra work for you today. I've taken two excerpts on this Tactical Tuesday out of the episode two or part two, episode 476 of James Warden that was released back in May. And I want to present them to you here so that you can get a glimpse of what you missed if you did not, in fact, listen to that episode. Today, we're going to talk about James' perspective on the evolution of electric vehicles. If you're unfamiliar, James Warden is a serial entrepreneur who created two separate companies, both tied to the name Solectria. The first was one of the pioneers of electric vehicles, and he talks about the evolution of the electric vehicle industry in a time pre-Tesla, pre-Rivian, pre-all of these manufacturers agreeing that electric was actually the reality we were destined to embody for electric vehicles. Many of them were pushing back, and all of them were only really dabbling in electric vehicles, with the exception of Solectria and a handful of others, because of the California Air Resource Board regulations. We explained that in episode one. I would encourage you to go listen to it in episode two. This segment, the first segment, just focuses on the evolution of electric vehicles from James' perspective as he has seen it unfold over history. And then the second segment talks all about listening to the customer. But we'll get back to that in just a moment. I'm so glad that you've decided to join us here and level up your game. Remember, you can find resources, links, and access to today's guest and all the other guests by accessing show notes over at mysuncast.com. While you're at it, I hope that you'll subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a rating and review. It really does help others discover this content just like you have today. Now let's get down to business. These are two practical excerpts from the long-form James Warden interview that I hope you'll give a listen to, and I hope that it'll prompt you to go back and listen to the longer one. Tune up your skills, Solar Warrior. We're diving into a practical, tactical conversation here on Suncast. This is segment one about the evolution of the electric vehicle industry.
How do you summarize for those who ask about the history of Solectria as a company, as an electric vehicle pioneer? How do you summarize kind of the evolution of the industry? And I realize that might be complicated and difficult, but I presume you've got more practice than I have at listening to it. I'd love to hear you talk about that.
The electric vehicle, well, the take of the electric vehicle industry in the late 80s into the 90s, that rendition of the electric vehicle industry, you know, now we feel electric vehicles are here to stay. There's no way. That's too bad. You know, the world over is a given. But in 1990, we were trying to really create the industry. And it was very strange. You had a few people building conversions the old way with series wound motors and wet lead acid batteries and, you know, stick shift gearboxes that were never going to be for the general public, but they're more tinkerers and do some fun things. Then you had a couple of companies across. There ended up being about four of them in the end around the country. I often think that we are the most advanced in many ways with the technology we brought in, building lightweight, efficient, easy to use automatic cars
that have withstood the test of time.
That's actually true. In Boston, but we've crushed a few cars that have rusted away over time with too many winters. The salt's just terrible. But which is why we built the composite cars. You know, the Sunrise. Yeah. You know, from the Lightspeed, the Flash, the Sunrise. But you know, this picture. I don't know if that EV1. It shows its impact. You can't quite read that, but on the door it says impact. Great name for a car.
Yeah.
But between General Motors, I put them as sort of the poster child of a car company, a traditional car company, that the people in the EV1 program loved EVs. The salespeople, the designers, developers that came, a lot of them came up with AeroVironments, and then GM joined together because AeroVironments built their solar car for them to compete in the 1987 wow. World Solar Challenge in Australia when we went at the same time. And GM sponsored us as well. But there were those people, and then there was a corporate and people around in and around corporate that absolutely detested the whole idea of electric vehicles and everything it represented. And they were completely against each other. And when Bob Stemple was at General Motors and we met him, he was an advisor to us while he was there. And but more when he left there, when he went to Energy Conversion Devices, Stan Orsinsky's nickel metal hydride battery business. But he promoted this car at the very beginning. When he left, Chairman Smith, Roger Smith, he rolled out the final production version of the EV1, which is not this car. This is the AeroVironment Impact that was built for General Motors. But he never really liked the electric car. He didn't want it to succeed. And, you know, General Motors and Ford, Toyota, Honda, they were forced into it by California Air Resources Board, the whole CARB, 2%, then 10% EVs by 2003. And it kept ratcheting up. And even more scary than that, as if that's not scary enough for the traditional automakers, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Jersey, we're all going to follow suit. They're like, as long as this happens in California, we're going to take that on too, as some things tend to go. But what happened was that California mandate single-handedly amped up and put a lot of power into the EV incarnation of the 90s and single-handedly destroyed it. And that's the sad thing. If in some ways, I think if it had never happened, it might have grown more organically and carefully, but it probably wouldn't have happened. But if they just kept that mandate, if they had forced it, because the secret truth is, and this is a true story, you'd have to dig deep into some annals of some people that would probably not even talk about it. But General Motors and Ford both had very close relationships with us, and we were deeply involved in what was actually going to be their products to meet the mandates. The Force was going to be made in that Ingersoll, Ontario, Canada, General Motors Suzuki joint venture with our whole kit was going to be made on their production line, and that's what was going to power what they needed, not the EV1. The EV1 cost, they said, $1 million a copy. It was a $1 billion program. They delivered 1,000 cars. That's the story. And then they crushed them all, which is really sad. I mean, it's a cool car. Why would you crush it?
And that's the documentary in a nutshell. Who killed the electric car?
Yeah. And that's a very sad story.
And so it's true then that at some point, the exit for your original investor was to Chevy and Ford and basically creating the prototype or the platform on which the original automakers could build electric cars.
Yeah. And so we didn't use a Ford car, but how were we tied in with Ford? We had, this is 100% truth, we had a $2.5 million contract. Sounds little today. But for providing the drive system for the Ford Think City car. It was a little two-seat car. If anyone out there remembers the Ford Think City, something, one of those, two of those three awards, was a little car, plastic-bodied car, and we were part of the drive system for that. And they literally, when the mandate got killed, they pulled the contract out from under us. It was a full contract. We were operating on it. We had to work to collect on it. Wow. It was Anita, being the smarter one of the two of us, she was in control of HR, you know, people stuff, finance, and accounting. She had to collect on that, and it was a tough one to get that, to get some of that money out from Ford. But the whole industry just ended. And, you know, we had gone through, we'd made pickup trucks, we made step vans, we made school bus drive systems. We moved more and more into making drive systems. But then as the EV mandate died, all the utilities and government fleets just turned off all the orders. No more orders came.
Yep.
And we sold a few cars here and there, like Robin Williams bought one, a two-seat Force GT with an extra motor and an extra batteries and longer range. You know, we were building NiCad and nickel metal cars that were getting, you know, 120 miles in a converted car.
Yeah. Is it true that Force is from the Star Wars?
There are a lot of influences. If you look at the S in Selectria, there's none right here, but the S in Selectria is a Star Wars shaped S.
Is that right?
And, you know, Force, light speed.
So the font is...
Some pieces of the font are borrowed from Star. We don't extend the S the way the Star Wars is.
I recognize there's probably some trademark, if not some direct conversations with their organization to ensure that you're not infringing.
Yes, we got a letter from Lucasfilm when The Force came out, and with no money changing hands, we settled on we can use the name Force, but we can never refer to Star Wars movie. We can never say phrases like "May the Force be with you."
Right.
And we joked about it, but we joked about it telling people about the story of the Lucas letter.
Right.
So it made it even more fun. And so a lot of those names, Lightspeed, The Flash, The Sunrise, not so much, but these names are kind of influences of Star Wars. Fun stuff.
That's a fun fact for sure. I'm going to push forward in time a decade, because with the sunset of the CARB incentives, thus entrepreneurial quandary. What are we really doing and how are we going to build this company? History would show that you did successfully sell Solaria Corporation. What was that exit about? Like, how did you actually salvage the company into a sense of like you actually got a chance to have an entrepreneurial exit?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. And again, a lot of other people involving successfully guiding this process. But we had migrated into a company that I always said to myself, my wife and others, that anyone can be this company. We were basically doing a lot of R&D contracts, corporate customers, government contracts, military. We did a lot of military contracts, building power supplies and DC-DC converters. We made inverters that made three-phase with an artificial neutral without ground, like all these different things for hospital Humvees and hybrid Humvees. And I went home some days, you know, literally smelling like diesel fuel.
Wow.
Like, you know, like
you became experts in power conditioning and, and conversion devices.
It was just the dream was gone. The spark was gone. It was I hate hybrids. I've always hated hybrids. And Elon Musk says it best. It puts the worst things of both types of cars all in one car. You're lugging around these batteries that you don't use all the time. Then you're lugging around this engine when you're doing your short-term driving. But it's a means to an end. And you know, in the 90s, there were people in our company. We did experiments with hybrids early on. We did a clip on the back hybrid. We did a little trailer. We never brought an engine into the vehicle. I wouldn't have that. But our CFO was dead set on basically the concept of the Insight and the Prius, that if we did that customer before they did that product. But I was like, that's going to be too complicated. It's too much stuff in the car. And to this day, you know, now that hybrids are the big thing right now, of course, all of us future thinking people, we can see them sunsetting. I mean, they're done. Yeah. They're like, oh my God, hybrids are just, oh, I can't wait till they're gone.
Yeah.
They're actually I found some statistics. They're the highest chance of a fire in a car.
Wow.
It's like, why would that be? Well, they have twice as much technology all wrapped together. They got liquid gasoline, they got fuel pumps, and they have batteries.
Isn't it arguable though, that without the, well, like Toyota Prius as an example, without that, it's arguable that we wouldn't have the electric vehicle revolution that we have today?
That's a great question. In a way, hybrids helped and hurt electric vehicles. Because when the mandate came, at the same time the mandate died, guess what year it was? Around 2000, when the inklings of the heavy losses were, and what came out? The Insight and then the Prius. So all our individual customers, save Robin Williams and a few other people, went and ran to this thing they can get that, well, it's not electric. I really want an electric car, but they're too expensive and I can't find one. And so they all could buy this mass market car.
Yeah.
And yes, everyone was driving a very small part electric car, but you couldn't plug it in.
It delayed by 20 years. The inevitable.
I think Toyota and Honda did an unbelievable job coming out with a really neat high mileage gas car called a hybrid that delayed the electric vehicle industry by 15 or 20 years. Now, at the time, why in 2000 couldn't we succeed in our own selling? Then the Force became a $33,000 four-seat subcompact car that could go 50 miles lead, or a $70,000 car that goes 120 miles nickel monohydride. That's it. That's all she wrote. That's what you get.
Yeah.
And it was the best car for the money by far and a long way that you could buy the money. That's pretty poor performance results.
Yeah.
You know, and the acceleration was pretty good in the city. It was great, but not that great on the highway.
Yeah.
You could get up to 70, but it took a while to get there. You know, you could go a few exits on the highway, no problem, but that was it. So the batteries were still the issue, the lead acid batteries. We put the smallest battery of anyone making EVs, just 800 pounds of batteries in that Metro. We kept it with the passengers well within the GVW, because you can't go over GVW. A lot of other people are going over GVW.
What's the GVW?
Gross vehicle weight. Yeah, gross vehicle weight. So the gross vehicle weight defined and developed into any car is tested, and safety, the life of the bearings, the strength of all the metal.
The roll capacity.
Someone else spent millions of dollars getting that number established.
Right.
We can't not use that number.
Right.
So the gross vehicle weight is stamped in the car forever, and we can't change that. So, you know, we reduced our carrying capacity. You know, we had, I think, for a time, like 550 pounds. So it better be two men and two fairly light, either kids or women in the back, but not four guys. And sure, we went on test drives with four guys at a utility when we were delivering a car, teaching them about it. But, you know, you can over GVW a car with an extra load for some short amount of time, but it better not be here day in and day out. Most of the time, cars are used in fleets with one or two people anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not an issue. But anyway, the lead acid battery and then the nickel metal battery was not bad. It was about $20,000. It's kind of a lot of money. And it got the car 120 miles, which at the time was pretty exciting.
Better than the Leaf.
But yeah, I suppose.
Yeah.
But at the Leaf that came out, 2011?
Yeah.
The real pioneer to get a car once lithium batteries came.
Yeah.
And that was what we were missing, the lithium batteries. And I was afraid of lithium. It was just starting to come when we were, you know, when there were fires in airplanes from people's cell phones or computers. Then Boeing had a new plane that had a lithium battery that caught on fire. And then they put back the NiCads real
quickly.
But anyway, the batteries just weren't there. And Elon and Nissan, 2010-11, that's when it really started to get exciting.
Yeah.
And you know, I started playing with lithium myself at home by 2012-13.
Yeah.
Now I have four cars with lithium.
While the electric vehicle industry was a foundational and formational part of who James Worden and his eventual entrepreneurial empire became, it by no means was the end of the story. When we return, you'll hear how James thinks about listening to the customer as part of the process of developing products at any product company. We'll be back in a moment.
The first product that I installed was the NEMA 4X. You guys like really had the only, I'll say, bulletproof stainless steel cabinet. And Allison must have sold thousands of them. Allison Duffy, she's the queen of solar sales, in our opinion.
She works with Andrew now.
Yeah, she does. What about innovations like that? Were there core decisions like that that ultimately you made a bet and they worked out for you?
Yeah, I mean, the stainless steel cabinet's another example of where customer voice just told us what to do. It's like if a customer's asking for something, there's something simple. It's like, how many can we sell if we do this thing they're asking for?
Yeah.
How weird is it? Because you have to say no sometimes.
That's right.
But what's it going to cost us? And most people think, oh my God, stainless steel enclosure, that's going to be so expensive. We're never going to sell very many. But is it really just getting a different enclosure material? What's the big deal? That's what So I go with the enclosure manufacturer. What is it going to cost in stainless steel? Oh, it's going to, okay, it's going to be three times the money for the cabinet. Okay, big deal. So, you know, we changed the bug screens from from just plain aluminum to fiberglass so they wouldn't also be attacked by salt. And we went through other things in design to harden them up. We hard anodized the exterior aluminum parts that would get corroded. And we put Nolox paste on our terminals inside the inverter because, you know, we're blowing air through the inverter. So we didn't want those terminals to corrode. And a lot of these features ended up going into standard products. We actually, because those people asked for a more ruggedized salt air environment near the beach, like at a Hilton hotel on the roof where it got helicoptered in Hawaii with another Allison, not genius, you know, those benefits can fall back and to make the regular, where it was cost effective, we just dumped all those things into the regular design. So we were forced to learn something we didn't really want to learn. No, there were other people came and said, oh, we want to use the inverter for wind. Can you make the software special for wind? And we looked at it and we said, who's this company? How many are they going to sell? Are there other markets we can sell to? No, not really, and not very much. So we said no to like five different wind projects. I think one thing we sold to where they said, we'll make a separate box that'll control your inverter so you don't have to change the software. And I think we said yes to that, and it didn't turn out to be anything. You know,
yeah,
it's like we just sold a standard product, and we gave them some way to like connect to the data port to get some information in and out. But I can't number them. The number of, there's so many features and options that came from customers. It goes all the way back to the cars. Like utilities, for some god-awful reason, they wanted cruise control. It's like, why do you need cruise control if the car goes 50 miles?
Yeah.
Like, just use the accelerator. It's like, nope, that's not how we're gonna listen to them. And we put cruise control on it. It was two buttons.
Yeah.
Set cruise and disable cruise. And it cost us like 15 cents. Okay, it cost us $20. But we sold that option for like $400.
Right.
And every customer bought it in the utility
Amazing.
And the fleets. Because they buy a Ford Taurus cruise control, they're going to buy our car's cruise control.
Right.
It doesn't matter that it doesn't need to be there. Are we taking advantage of people? No, they ask for it. It's an option. You don't have, it's expensive. You don't have to pay $400 for it. Another example would be, early on we knew we needed air conditioning and battery thermal management, things that we need to baby the battery. But, you know, with the inverters, you know, having a good display that the user can push buttons, can go through different things, can use it for diagnostics. Our inverter started with blinking LEDs. You remember the days of the SMAs that you'd knock on it, the LEDs would blink at you, and you'd have to count them and then look in the manual. And that's how the early inverters were. So we added an LCD display, alpha numeric display, that could tell customers all sorts of things. You could go through screens. And that at the same time became our web-based monitor, so you could set your access codes and whatever to get onto your network. So, many features like that got added, and people wanted fused disconnects, or they wanted unfused disconnects. And I was like, oh. So we actually had a very complex set of SKUs and options, and it made some of the management and some of the operational stuff quite difficult. And that's where IBK and her purchasing team and the operations and the build people, I mean, they had a lot to handle. We had configuration sheets that would drive people insane. There were so many different check boxes and unchecked boxes. They don't want this on there. They do want it there. And it became like a la carte, like an a la carte menu, like going to Chinese and getting dim sum.
Was that a feature or a bug about the Selectria company as a development?
Well, that's a great question. Does too much complexity then hold us back? We loved we called them vanilla. You know, like the only inverters we built not to spec were vanilla inverters. We would just build some, like when the line had extra time, we built some vanilla inverters. And if someone called in and they said, yep, we can build that inverter, the lead time's 3 weeks, but by the way, we have a vanilla inverter, this and this. Oh, we even have a stainless steel available that some customer didn't take one of them. And sometimes people buy those and they loved it because they could get them immediately.
Yeah.
Big commercial inverter, could be 100 kilowatt, it's in stock. So people love that. But with the residential inverters, there was no customization. We knew that there was no way those could be customized. We built residential panels at the time that had visible blade, lockable AC and DC disconnect. They had meter sockets. So that was custom. You could order it 17 different ways. You could get one, two, or three inverters up on one panel. The unions love this. I don't know why, because it's a lot less labor for them. And usually they like labor in the union. Huh. But they are the ones that got, the unions got us to do these residential panels first. And then we sold thousands of residential panel assemblies, we called them. But with a commercial inverter, they're the exact opposite. They're completely customizable. We knew we were building this giant box, and a fused or unfused disconnect difference is like a couple hundred, $150 different,
right?
Maybe $400 or $600. So for a 400 amp disconnect, big disconnect like that. So why not let the customer have that money? Why do we want to take more money, be less competitive out there, and be wasting material when they're going to have a circuit breaker right there? They don't need another fuse in the inverter. It's just wasting a little energy. It's wasting parts, more reliability. We're going to get a call on something. So if they want it that way, we've had things where you could turn disconnects. And the salespeople single-handedly loved and hated all these options because they needed to educate customers and all that. We had training sessions that were like 40 slides long. And I remember giving them, sometimes with not enough sleep, sometimes with too much partying at a late night at a trade show. Exactly. They had big parties there. And at 7 in the morning, we have 50 electricians. And Scott and I, he also had dark sunglasses. He was very professional. He dragged me along, and we'd be up in front of these guys with donuts and coffee, and we're teaching them with all our funny little antics about all these options and how you order them. And they'd get quite confused, but they realize, I can get it this way, I can get it that way. And so it was, that is interesting though, that you brought in that, was that a curse or a blessing? And I think most customers saw it as, we're really bending for the customer. We've set up our whole system. We've made a, a well-oiled machine, some people called it at the time, to handle a completely custom build inverter that doesn't seem like custom. It's more like when you order a car, like when you order your Tesla online. Okay, we didn't get that far.
Yeah.
But it just drops in and all the stuff you order. Okay, they don't have many options. But cars that have a lot of options, it just the right options drop in. It doesn't... It's a little
like
more
a
overhead.
Configurator, basically.
Like a configurator.
Yeah.
And it became very mechanized. With these great sheets, the traveler would follow all the way through the plant. And the inspectors all the way down the line, right up to the end, you'd inspect to make sure every option that's on there got on there. Sometimes there were custom. There was a line for custom options where someone wanted... They wanted the label to be 499 kilowatts,
right,
not 500.
You can see how, you know, listening to the way you talk about it and the, what we all know about the ultimate... you know, again, the ultimate result, successful asset sale. What I want folks to take away is, as an entrepreneur, listening to the customer, focusing on quickly deploying an idea and loving the customer with customer service, which is something that in our industry, unfortunately, is not a common feature. Your market will find you. The thing that resonates for me, and you can't script these, you can't time this. You in the mid-80s could not have guessed that CARB was going to come out with an incentive program that would forecast California and that would ultimately lift Solectria into, we'll call it profitability, but certainly viability. I remember in 2006-07 seeing Solectria and thinking, there's no way I would buy this. SMA has a similar product. Better roadmap, better, candidly, like a better sales force in California where I was selling solar.
Grass Valley.
Yeah. And you guys had a great, you had a huge customer base here in the Northeast, but in California, nobody cared until
Allison Duffy.
Well, until Duffy for sure. She's a force all of her own, right?
Yeah.
And there is a bit of like, if we had time, we could talk about like the importance of recruitment to your car, to the team, et cetera. And I remember like spending, you know, it's just seeing Duffy. She's a force of nature as a salesperson. But 2008, global financial crisis, Obama institutes the now famous American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, which mandated for government buildings American made.
Oh, I remember that now.
How important was that to the life of Solectria?
I know it came up from time to time. But I don't think it had a giant impact. I mean, we did, we got on some military installations. We got on some government buildings, a lot of schools.
I wonder
used
if that'd
us.
Be Allison's answer, because I felt like Solectria was the soup du jour for government facilities from then on. I feel like that was you guys locked that market.
Yeah. I mean, maybe others will know more. Allison Duffy, Scott Bowden, Brad Sherman, they did a lot of the early selling in that time, the big sell, the big growth years. I mean, multiple 3 years in a row, 300% growth every year. I mean, just crazy through that 2008 to 2010 area. That was the really crazy, out of body experience. Like, how do we even keep up with this marathon?
Yeah.
Like with manufacturing,
do you feel like anybody doing like who was a peer of yours was having the same experience?
I would guess that some did, but I don't know if they had that much growth that many years in a row, because the industry grew at standard then 30 to 40% a year, but we were growing 300%. Mm-hmm. So we were taking market share and getting growth at the same time. We were taking someone else's market share every one of those years. Mm. All the way through, we kind of went down to like that 20, 30% growth. We were just kind of keeping up with industry growth.
Sure.
And that's when things were getting really tough. And that's actually when Yaskawa came into the picture when it made a lot of sense for their lower cost manufacturing in the Midwest, still making things in the US, and their like unbelievable level of quality. I mean, their Yaskawa's level of quality.
And Solectria was known in the industry as among the highest level of quality and attention to detail, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
Before we go to Yaskawa, one other question. Those who are currently operating in the United States market will recognize a name like Chen Power. But back in 2006 to 2010 timeframe, while Chent in China was recognized as a mega top 10 company, they had almost no presence here. Our friends Ed and Kyle Cherik and these guys were early in to help sort of raise that company purview in the United States. But my sense is that a lot of their credibility came from a partnership with a little-known company in Massachusetts or a little known company on the Western region of the United States, at least. How did the relationship with Chint come about? And you'd mentioned that, we'll point out that you said the residential line was not customized. It was like churn. It was just a standard product. Talk to me about the decision to partner on manufacturing with a company like Chint rather than continue manufacturing in-house.
Yeah. So the Chint relationship came along because these wall hung inverters were moving very fast. Mm-hmm. We had the big American made heavy mm-hmm. transformer base. Yeah. We had peaked the efficiency real nice. We got up to great values, 96 and a half, even 97% right. with amorphous core transformers. We had run out to the technology limit of how good you could do with that. But it still involved this big ass transformer that didn't need to be there.
Yeah.
And with that big transformer, it commanded a big cabinet that mm-hmm. adds money. And then all the other electronics weren't a whole lot different. But it forced the design to be a certain size and weight. And we saw the writing on the wall that we need to have that type of inverter.
Transformerless.
And we were transformerless wall hung. And we weren't sure if it was going to be a fad or how much it was going to take over. That was a mistake. But the genius I'd say we did have was to, and we looked at several companies, but we partnered with Chint because they didn't have much of a presence over here. We tested the product. It looked pretty good. The quality looked pretty reasonable. We had some troubles with it. I'll tell you, we had a bunch we had to replace. And with our reputation, we just paid for it. We replaced them and replaced them and replaced them. And you know, quality, you know, in general, they had a pretty strong quality standard. We went over there and visited the plant countless times. We had that close a relationship. But in the end, in the meantime, we were developing our own inverter that was going to be much more reliable and, you know, every bit as efficient, have more features, a few more options. But it ended up taking a bit too long.
Yeah.
And the best thing out of it came our 1500 volt. That's a great product. I say R, but I started that and got about halfway down the road when my wife and I left the company.
Yeah.
When they moved the manufacturing to the Midwest, that was kind of like a sad time for us, because that's half of what we built was going away, and those people got laid off. A lot of them got offered jobs if they want to move to the Midwest and have White Castle burgers instead of whatever we have over here.
Yeah.
But the 1500 volt was a very successful product, and I believe it still is to be a 600 volt AC, 1500 volt DC, very cost effective in a much smaller box. And I think they're doing a quarter megawatt in a box that weighs about 400 pounds. You know, it doesn't hang on a wall, but it's utility scale.
Yeah.
But it's much, you know, different than central inverters. A whole lot less mass and money.
Yeah.
In terms of dollars per watt, it's a much better benefit.
Did Yaskawa value the residential line of inverters as a core piece of the asset they were buying?
No, I believe that Yaskawa America didn't really like at all a lot of these, as you call it, private labeled things. And you know, there's a certain rhyme to that reason. And the residential was completely that. We had a very close relationship with Delta. It was previously mm-hmm. Exendis.
Yeah.
We made the inverter kind of our own. We had one of Michael Zirkel's early things was to work on the software in Germany. So it's Germany. He worked there for this first couple of months and then came to the company and worked on some wacky projects, some solar driven like blimp thing at our company for some, again, one of these are research projects. And then he started working on the commercial inverter. And then he was working exclusively on a 2003 area. But that inverter line, we were pretty much the only outlet for it for this, you know, the whole America's area. And it was very much integrated with these residential panels, so it could fit different codes in different states. You could get it a la carte, again, kind of very customized to the panel. Or you could just buy the inverter in a box and do it all yourself if you really like to tinker with all the other stuff. You know, we sold tens of thousands of those, but we never got to the sales level of, you know, someone like SolarEdge or Enphase at the time. And then Yaskawa didn't want to continue the residential line after about, I don't know, 2015 or 16. And they wanted to end it. You know, I'd always wanted to be in residential, commercial, and utility scale grid tied inverters. I'd be that focused, but not even more focused within only some those inverters. And I can see different ways. They SCOW want to focus in on stuff that we actually make.
Yeah.
You know, because that's where the real value add is. And I can understand that, but it's not what I originally did or would do.
All right, Solar Warrior. I really expect that was a fantastic insight for you. The interlude that we've provided, this 30-minute snippet out of a long, long conversation that we had with James Warden. If you are so inclined, I hope that you'll queue up episodes 475 and 476, these two excerpts being part of episode 476. In fact, right after the snippet you just completed, James goes into the discussion around why, in fact, Yaskawa ended up buying Solectria inverters and incorporating them into their century-old Japanese brand of industrial manufacturing. If you like these kinds of conversations, and it seems like you do, but you haven't yet subscribed to Suncast, I would encourage you to just click on the subscribe or follow if you're over on Spotify and click on the bell so that you're notified every time one of these episodes comes through. You don't want to miss out on our practical, tactical conversations and insights geared towards helping you in your career and business building journey. I'd love to hear from you. What was it that inspired you to listen to Suncast at all? What did you glean from this conversation that you've listened in on today? Would you share with me and my team and James over on LinkedIn or Twitter? You can find our socials, as of course, you can find all of the other useful links and resources, as we always link them on the show notes at mysuncast.com. We'd love it if you would like and comment and even share one of our posts about the episode, or even go back, hopefully, now that you've subscribed and listened to the longer form episodes with James. This interview with James was one of the rare opportunities to actually hear more about James the person rather than James the entrepreneur and CEO of Solectria. And it really was a deep dive into he and his wife Anita and the phenomenal story that they created together. Thanks again for dedicating your time for listening to this Tactical Tuesday. I'd also like to take a moment to thank the sponsors who help make Suncast free to you each and every week. It's definitely not free to produce this deep, involved content, especially when I have to fly to remote locations like Northern Massachusetts to capture these meetings in person, like I did with James. You can learn more about our supporting sponsors at mysuncast.com/sponsor, and that's also where you can learn how to partner with us to reach thousands of solar warriors and clean tech champions twice a week, just like they do. Remember, you are what you listen to. Thanks again for showing up, Solar Warrior. It's half the battle.